The densely populated Adaraj neighborhood lies in the heart of Gaza City. Residents of that neighborhood still keep a copy from a local newspaper that had the front page news of the sad night of July 23, 2002. Back then, the U.S. made F-16 warjets of the Israeli occupation army turned the calm of the neighborhood into horror and fear.
It was a quiet, peaceful and calm night, despite the extreme heat. I was not sure we heard or not. Personally, I heard nothing. I rather felt a pressure inside me, or something pressing me inside out. I could feel nothing. It was like something carried me a meter high from the ground for a while, then dropped me on the ground. The power was cut. Then I felt the horrors of the Day of Resurrection.
An F-16 warjet dropped a one-ton bomb on the neighborhood to assassinate Salah Shadeh, the leader of the military wing of the Islamic resistance movement Hamas, resulting in 17 fatalities, including 11 children and 3 women, while 176 people were injured and tens of houses were damaged.
The Adaraj neighborhood crime is an example to be studied of a war crime against civilians, not against Sheikh Salah Shahada himself. They are willing to kill. They made a decision by different political and security levels to target a family amid civilians while they were fully aware of the dire consequences of this. I expected that something happened to us. We moved from one area to another. Our house, street, and neighborhood did not look like they used to be anymore. There were rubble, destruction, and people crying for help, while people from other areas rushing to help them. I heard stories from people saying a plane fell behind Al-Ashi carpentry next to our house. Not our family sustained the greatest loss, where they lost 7 family members.
A decade after the massacre, Matar family members who lost a lot abstain from talking about their catastrophe.
The family was overwhelmed due to that. If you say anything about what happened, they would recall the sadness. I will tell you about Ra'id, who is the elder and who lost 3 kids, 2 boys and 1 girl, as well as his wife. His shock was deep. Until now, he has nervous collapse every time we bring up the subject.
Ahmad Matar was 12 at the time of the massacre. He broke the silence to talk about the inhumane crime that happened to his family.
My sister and sister-in-law with her 3 kids died, as well my 2-month-old niece. After 3 weeks, my grandmother died. The bodies of my nephews were found 2 days after the incident. They found the bed where my nephew slept turned upside down with loads of rubble on it. A committee came from hospital and checked the matter, taking them all to the hospital, then right away to the graveyards. It's a typical war crime, and those who committed it, not only at the security or military level, but also at the political level, must be brought to justice. Those who gave them the political endorsement and made the decision for such action are still free. We didn't see them standing in trial. Whenever there is any breakthrough in a given country to file a complaint or prosecute one of those, the state changes the law of the country to protect the Israeli criminal.
The Israeli occupation apparently relied on the fact that none in the world is going to hold them accountable for their vicious crimes. That made them further torture and kill Palestinians ever since the eruption of the Al-Aqsa Intifada in 2000. It is not likely for Palestinians that a day would pass without a massacre. On May 5, 2003, the Israeli occupation invaded the area of Az-Zaytun neighborhood, killing 17 people, injuring dozens more, and destroying many houses. The outstanding event was burying 3 residents alive.
My son Ihab and his colleagues, Amir and Walid Azam, were injured during the first night. The ambulance crew tried to rescue them, but they couldn't because the snipers were on the roofs in the area. They tried to throw ropes to them and tried to turn around. My son Ihab asked for water. The Ndola family, may Allah reward them, threw 3 bottles to him, but none of them reached. Between 7 and 8 o'clock in the morning, the Israeli bulldozer buried them alive.
Nine years after Ihab's death and the birth of Ihab Jr., baby Ihab only knew his father from photos, but he knows who killed him.
She was 5 months pregnant when her husband was killed from the Israeli occupation army. She gave birth. We looked after the child and raised him. He went to kindergarten for 2 years, then to school. He's smart and he's already joining the third grade.
The baby, who was still a fetus, was deprived from his father, but was not deprived from the type of life children of Rafah experience along the borderline with Egypt. Rafah City and its suburbs are a living testimony of tens of massacres that targeted the city, especially Tell el-Sultan massacre during the Israeli incursion on the eve of May 12, 2004.
I live in Tell el-Sultan. I was in the yard when I started receiving calls with news about Tell el-Sultan. People were saying that the area was closed by the Israeli occupation army. People were saying they are leaving Tell el-Sultan. Then they were saying that Israeli occupation army is watching people closely. Anyone who was going to the roof was shot. For example, a girl was trying to feed the pigeons, then was shot down. Our neighbor, who was a well-known sport person, was shot by a sniper when he was looking from the window.
They could see he was an incompetent. He was sitting at home and doing nothing. He wanted to get ready for midday prayer. I asked him to hide with us under the stairs. His brother Ibrahim came down, telling us he was injured.
One of the harshest moments Umm Ibrahim has experienced was the sight of her son laying dead on the ground while she couldn't do anything but cry.
Can you imagine how would we laid and covered him by blanket? We still crying till before sunset. When the ambulance came from Gaza, they were told someone was shot dead and that his parents are about to lose their minds. Then the ambulance crew came on foot with our neighbor to carry him. And I carried him on my chest, laying him at our neighbor's back. They took him while we were asking Allah to bless him the paradise.
Ibrahim's body was buried while his family stayed alive. and people of the neighborhood remained hungry and wounded, waiting for a helping hand to be extended to them. The children of Rafah answered their call and took to the street to break the siege.
When the demonstration proceeded from Zareb roundabout towards Tell al-Sultan to break the siege on them, the tanks targeted the demonstration at Zareb roundabout. They first hit the building, destroying the doors, as you could see. Those are the signs of the shrapnels that scattered all over people, as well as the doors' shrapnels. The second and third shells targeted the very same place in the building, with 3 or 4 seconds interval between each. Missiles were coming from tanks and planes, hitting the walls and doors to make shrapnels and hit people. People closed all small alleys and streets. People were falling on the ground due to injuries, and people were carrying other bleeding people. The area became horrible. People didn't know where to take other injured people. The Israeli occupation army's checkpoint was there in front of you, and the demonstrators were blocking all the way back to Rafah.
The children marched, couldn't make it to Tell al-Sultan, where the Israeli tanks and war jets intercepted their attempt, targeting them and killing 9 organizers and leaving 45 others wounded, raising the death toll of Tell al-Sultan massacre to 60, most of them children. This huge number of martyrs surpassed the capacity of Rafah Hospital morgue. Dead bodies needed to be kept refrigerated till proper burial.
We thought we need to find a vegetable refrigerator. We started to put martyrs there. The death toll reached approximately 65 people. After the siege was lifted, people started coming to identify the bodies of their relatives. All martyrs were brought to the playground with their families who came from Tell al-Sultan. Then, the biggest funeral ever started with the bodies of 65 martyrs taken to the burial as a result of the siege and the demonstration. There is an enormous number of crimes in Rafah, Jabalia, Isbit Abd Rabbu, Bit Hanun, Saafin, and Ghalia family on the beach. As long as there is occupation, there will be crimes. Such a fascist criminal occupation, as we see, will continue those crimes with no discrimination between kids, women, and men.
The continuity of massacres against Palestinian people is associated with the Israeli occupation that has been practicing a daily policy of ethnic cleansing in Palestine for more than 60 years. Hajjaj family from Ashjaiya used to meet every evening to have whatever available food together.
We were sitting here around this area doing some barbecue on Saturday, July the 8th, 2006, around sunset time. Then the unmanned drone targeted us with 3 missiles. I saw my mother flying and falling down with her chair, while Rawan, who was sitting on her lap, was thrown 10 meters away by the explosion. I saw Muhammad jumping off the chair on the sand. Many shrapnels hit his back, and he died right away. I sneaked through an opening to the door and kept walking and falling till the ambulance came and they picked me.
21-year-old Muhammad didn't survive the shrapnel that penetrated his body, as well as his 50-year-old mother, whose bodies were cut into small pieces that are hardly recognized. 6-year-old Rawan, who did no harm to anyone, was killed too. Other family members who didn't die were injured and are still suffering the consequences of the crime after 6 years.
My uncle carried me to the ambulance. Then I was taken to Al-Shifa hospital, undergoing several surgeries. I was injured in the arm and leg. I suffered a fracture and had internal fixation in my arms. I underwent several plastic surgeries for my arm. I had fractures in the joint bones and was advised that nothing can be done until I am older than 18. This means till the joint gets stiff. I was 14 years old at the time of the incident, and I am 19 years old now. And ever since the incident, I have my body full of shrapnels that I am suffering from. The most dangerous thing is the shrapnel in my head that I wanted to take out, but doctors advised that this would pose a risk, so it is still there while I am suffering from chronic headache.
Due to the severity of the injury, Ibrahim couldn't help it. Falling on the ground, he's still keeping the missile shrapnel that took the life of his family and left him with uncured wounds till now.
This plate was kept here with the parts of missiles that fell on our house, killing my brother, sister, and mother, and left me with a knee injury. I underwent a surgery. They fixed the knee internal fixation and told me it will be removed in a year. A year after, I removed it. But a while ago, it hurt me again. The acts of the occupation are evident. They are criminals, a state that's above the law. So it's not odd to be continuing those crimes. The rather odd thing is the silence and indulgence of the international community towards the justifications presented in this regard, as justifications are no longer acceptable when it comes to killing women and children. It's not acceptable morally, legally, or politically.
The Israeli occupation army never stopped searching for families to massacre. 4 months after Shijaiya massacre, Beth Hanun area was targeted at dawn, dated November 8, 2006. The artillery shells poured on Lathamna family. The family woke up in a pool of blood. Some of them lost their life, while others lived to recall the testimonies about the unforgettable memories.
The Israeli occupation army targeted us with 14 tank shells. The first tank shell was like an announcement of their will to kill us. Due to the shell, all the room glass fell on me. I could barely through the sheet. Then we all were in the street. People gathered to see what happened. Then the second shell hit, injuring and killing people. I was injured right here by the second shell. The third shell finished everybody. Then all the shells were random, either to kill any person who was still alive or to follow those who were fleeing the scene.
This is the massacre scene. All bodies were laid here. The blood here was to the knees. We had to bury the area with sands, while the blood was flowing outside to nearby places and all over the street. My son Arafat was targeted in this spot. They carried his head and arms without legs or body or stomach or anything. All of it became small scattered pieces besides the bodies of his brothers, uncles, and cousins who were all cut into pieces too.
The death toll among the Al-Athamna family reached 20 martyrs, most of them women and children. Majd Al-Athamna lost 6 family members, the last of which was her son Majdi, who died of a fatal disease he suffered after the loss of his son and brothers in that massacre.
I spent my life in more tragic events than the massacre. The last victim was my elder son, who lost his son, Saad. Majdi told me that he wished to visit Mecca as soon as he can, because he sensed his time is drawing closer. He wanted to perform Hajj. He did the Hajj, and after 20 days of his arrival from Mecca, he died. Can things get any more tragic? He had cardiac problem. Allah bless him.
The family at large consists of 64 members. 20 of them were killed, while 30 others were injured. So you can say that 90% of the family was devastated.
Al-Athamna family martyrs were buried in a graveyard near the buffer zone with the Israeli occupation in northern Gaza. The graveyard was targeted again during the Gaza War 2008-2009.
How are you, mother? May Allah grant you mercy. May Allah grant you mercy. May Allah grant you the paradise. May Allah make it easier for you. Even after they died, they were still targeted by the missiles of the Israeli occupation. Look how broken the graveyards are, how the missiles hit them. What can we do? You can't differentiate between people's graves. They are all mixed together now. They were broken and mixed after we built them. It's like they are saying, we are following you even when you are dead.
Al-Athamna family martyrs were killed twice, in 2006 and during the Gaza 23-day war, where a massacre was committed every day.
The night of January 11th, 2009 was particularly fierce. The shelling was heavy. Destruction and assassinations were horrible. We heard a cry for help from a wounded person asking Ziyada family to call ambulance. We tried to call but could never get through because all landlines and mobile communications were down. Then I tried to go and help that wounded person.
Ziyad Ziyadeh answered the call of help and sneaked to the place where the cries for help came from, despite the heavy shelling that night.
I kept walking towards the voice crying for help till I reached the place to find a very shocking and horrifying surprise. The man crying for help was my brother-in-law and my nephew, both on the ground. Both of them were barely alive, but my brother-in-law was talking to me and saying, I testify that there is no God to be worshipped but Allah, and Muhammad is the messenger, while my nephew had a deep injury in the head and chest, almost fatal injury. We tried to call the ambulance for help, but our cries were never answered. The war was fierce in the area. About 3 minutes later, we were surprised by an Apache missile targeting the wounded people and shattering their bodies into pieces.
The number of Ziyada family members who were killed reached 5, one of which was a fetus.
My mother was 80 years old. My sister was pregnant and expecting a birth within a week. My brother-in-law and nephew were civilians who were not involved in anything. My mother, may Allah have mercy on her, was here. My sister, Suhaib, was sitting next to her, and next to them was Suhaib. While Abu Suhaib was dead and thrown in this area, I was injured and was here exactly. I was injured in the head and leg, and I had also some shrapnels in the abdomen and back. The martyrs and I stayed in the street from 1 a.m. till 5 a.m. when the ambulances arrived.